This is Curl Up with a Cattail, and I'm Gwen Cooper, the New York Times bestselling author of numerous cat-centric titles, including Homer's Odyssey, A Fearless Feline Tale, or How I Learned About Love and Life with a Blind Wonder Cat, Spray Anything, More True Tales of Homer and the Gang, and The Book of Possum, Head Bonks, Raspy Tongues, and 101 Reasons Why Cats Make Us So, So Happy. We're here to celebrate all things feline and to tell inspirational cat tales. Let's get started. Hello, and welcome to an all-new episode of Curl Up with a Cattail with Gwen Cooper. I am Gwen Cooper, your host. Delighted, as always, to be here with you today. Coming up in just a few moments is an interview I am delighted to finally be able to bring to you. My good friend and yours, Jackson Galaxy, the cat daddy himself. And I'm actually going to keep this part of the podcast pretty short and tight this week for two reasons. Number one, because Jackson and I did have a nice chunky conversation, and I don't want this episode to run too long. And number two, and you may already be able to hear this in my voice, but oh my God, my allergies, my hay fever, it's just going nuts this year. I have no idea why it's so bad. So much worse than it's ever been, but I am so stuffy. I don't know what I sound like, but I don't imagine that I sound very good right now. I've been waiting a couple of days, and I've been hoping that this would subside before I had to record another episode of the podcast. Sadly, it has not. And I just don't want to,
subject you to this voice
for any longer than is absolutely necessary. And so, yeah, you know, just some bookkeeping stuff. It is the end of March as I record this. It is March 31st, so a very very happy Easter. It will be after Easter when most of you listen to this. Of course, my Patreon community gets to hear everything a few days before everybody else does. So a happy and healthy Easter to all those who celebrate it. And it is always a good time to remember that lilies, although very popular around this time of year, are incredibly, incredibly toxic for cats. They can cause permanent kidney damage. Even just one little speck of pollen or one little bit of a leaf from a lily plant can do lasting permanent damage to your cat, to your cat's kidneys, can even result in a fatality. So please be aware of that. As we head into springtime, I personally love lilies. I had lilies at my wedding. I love the way they smell. They're beautiful flowers, but don't have them in your home if you share a home with cats. And on that note, and with that PSA out of the way, I am going to take a very brief break of about 30 seconds or so. And when we come back, we will be speaking with Jackson Galaxy. So sit back, relax, get comfortable, and stick around for more Curl Up with a Cattail. Much for sticking around. Today's guest is a New York Times bestselling author and the host and executive producer of Animal Planet's long-running, wildly successful show, My Cat from Hell. He's also the founder of the Jackson Galaxy Project, a signature program of greatergood.org, which seeks to better the lives of at-risk animals by transforming the places they live and offering support to the people who care for them. His mission is to educate people about cats and deepen the human-feline bond while reducing the number of animals that end up in shelters. Please join me in welcoming one of my absolute favorite cat people, I guess is the best way to describe it, the cat daddy himself, Jackson Galaxy. Hello, and thank you so much for being here.
Hello, Gwen. It's great to be here.
We were talking before we started recording about, it's been a while since we've spoken you're making me nervous. And I'm actually not nervous. I don't know what's wrong with me. But yeah, it is really great to have you on the podcast. And tell us a little bit about what you're working on right now at the moment.
Well,
is that too open a question? Should I ask what's going on with my cat from hell? Is there a new season in the works?
I think my cat was great for exactly what it was and for exactly how long it went on. I think we had like a pandemic episode. That was the last one. So I think it was like 10 seasons all the way around, which I mean, when you think about, you know, and I knew you when that show first started, and we were just like, we were lucky as hell.
That show started, or I think right around the time.
Right around.
When you were like, you were a talking head on Animal. That's how I first came to know who you were. You were always popping up on like Cats 101 and shows like that as a talking head.
Yeah. I mean, it was an amazing thing to get out of that first season. I mean, I don't think anybody expected us to get past the first season with that show. Forever grateful. But I think the ability to take all that, bring it to YouTube where, you know, it's much more, it's a nimble platform. I get to speak to an audience in as close to real time as I'm ever going to get. I mean, you got to remember, like, we would film an episode and it would be, 8 months later that people would see it.
Very
and,
true.
You know, and then you're conversing about something that really had happened a long time ago. So it's been a real blessing, I think, to do that. And yeah, I mean, we're working on a number of projects that will sort of merge the TV entertainment with the YouTube sort of mentality. But yeah, it's a long answer to that question. No more episodes of my cat.
You know, it's interesting, and I think this is something you will probably relate to. But I mean, for me, the immediacy of social media became a real game changer, not just for what I do, but in terms of how I think about what I do, because much like you, I kind of found myself migrating more toward those platforms for my work, because like being a writer, the traditional publishing timeline, I mean, 8 months is lightning fast, as you know, in the publishing industry. I mean, even that 8 months, which is a long time. And so there is this sense, like when you start, and I'm sure you must have this much more even than I do, you must be in so much direct communication with so many people who are admirers of your work, who are in some way dependent on your work, that it starts to really feel just like you're perpetually behind when you are working with those kind of traditional media timelines.
Right. No, it's totally true. And you know, it's amazing that now, you know, when I get stopped on the street or whatever, it's half of it is, oh, you're the guy from the show, you know, and the other one is you're the guy who makes the videos. And I think it is, there are advantages and disadvantages for sure. I mean, making content is an endless, you know, hamster wheel. I mean, you're only as relevant sometimes as that last video that you put out. And I'm not complaining, believe me. I mean, I think we've gotten a really beautiful, large supportive community, and with the key being supportive, you know, we don't have a lot of people talking nonsense about, you know, the cats or the way we put out content. But it is, I mean, adjusting to that timeline is also bizarre and a lot. I you know, one of the other huge changes and something that has taken a lot of adjusting for me is I think, you know, that my cat ended right at the beginning of the pandemic. So this, you know, that the lockdown, the slowdown that happened in such breakneck reverse speed, you know, that I went from being out in the world pretty exclusively to being in my office pretty exclusively. And that was weird. And something I think I'm still trying to to wrestle with, is not being able to work hands-on with someone and their cat, and just being able to go over to people's houses like I did with you, you know, just to go to the house and hang out and you know, just to some degree or another work with your animals. And yeah, that's the biggest adjustment for sure.
And, you know, I was going to say a couple of things, which is, and I do have to apologize. I actually did not realize that the show was not running anymore, but in fairness, it is never not on Animal Planet. Has just been in continual rotation. I don't mean like every so often it pops up, but it is just always there. Yeah. And I still see, like I get emails from people that will say, oh, I saw you on Jackson Galaxy show last week. And I'm like, last week, I recorded that in 2016. So yeah, it's, you know, it's obviously, so I mean, and this actually happened to me within the last like 6 weeks, I think that happened to me. I got an email from somebody saying, I saw you last weekend on Jackson Galaxy show.
It's crazy. It really is. And let me tell you something, you know, before we started the podcast, we were talking about, you know, the paradox of aging. Well, let me tell you something. When you turn on the TV and you see yourself from, what was it, like, I don't know, 11 years ago?
Yeah.
And people are being introduced to your 11 years ago self, and then you get to meet them on the street. That'll, you know, do a number on you.
Hey, man, I wrote a memoir, you know, I mean, Homer's Odyssey, which launched my career in catdom, let's say. You know, I write about being in my 20s, and I mean, it really runs from the ages of 25 to 35, and there are still plenty of people. I mean, it, you know, we were talking about this before we started, that I've managed to get rights reversions for most of my books. I can't for Homer's Odyssey in the United States because it's just not that I'm complaining about this. It just still continues to sell very well. So my publisher obviously wants to hang on to it. But the point being that there are people meeting me now for the first time, like the me that's half the age of the me, literally half the age of the me that I am now. And I will tell you, when I got the rights reversion for Homer's Odyssey in the rest of the English speaking world, other than the United States, I had to retype the book from scratch because I'm cheap and I didn't want to buy the files from the publisher. I can't even tell you what an excruciating experience it is as a 52-year-old to encounter your 26-year-old self.
Oh, sure.
I'm like, how do people like this obnoxious, like, I mean, who thinks she knows so much and she doesn't know anything? And it was a very odd experience.
It's hard, man. I mean, it's funny. And I think I even made a video about this recently where I'm like, yeah, I know I speak as an authority. And anything that I'm authoritative about today, I hold full rights to tell you a couple of years from now that, hey, there's new research out there. There's stuff that we did not know before. There's stuff that I've learned along the way as you work with however many animals, and you can augment that point of view in media. On, like I said, I've made a video about it, but those books, it lives forever. And everything that I've written, I'm pretty well content with when it comes to the books like Catification and Total Cat Mojo, but Cat Daddy was a memoir. And I, you know, every time I think about, okay, well, the next pressing, I am going to rewrite this. I can't live with it. Like I read it and I'm like, okay, that's painful. That sort of level of naivete, not about Cass, but about me and my life, is painful to know that it's out there sometimes, you know?
I do know, but I will say it would appear, and this is advice I should apply to myself. I mean, it continued, you know, people really enjoyed that book. Obviously, if you look at reader reviews when it came out, and presumably they still do. And so however excruciating it might be for you, it is, you know, a document of a time, and there is something in it that resonates with people and that they relate to. And, you know, we are all our own worst critics and so on and so forth. But But yeah. I want to get back to something you were, because I'm going to use this as a segue and radically change the subject here for a moment. But just to the point of new information and new research, because I recently saw at some point within the last few months, there was yet another article. This time it was in the New Yorker, and it was one of these feral cats are a blight and killing birds and they live horrible lives. You know, speaking to the point of legacy, I always think that the no kill movement is not what it was when you and I were young, you know, when we were kids. Right. I mean, it has come so far forward. And certainly you are one of the people who has really helped bring it forward. And so, of course, when I first saw that article by Jonathan Franzen, who is a noted bird lover and cat hater, by the way. I immediately thought of you. And this was something I very much wanted to talk about. I'm assuming it is a somewhat sore subject with you.
It's a somewhat sore spot. I mean, it's a sore spot in a number of ways. And yes, I had my own little freak out reading Franzen's piece. And for reasons that are not altogether what you might think they were, I mean, I think that to a certain degree, the way he, in a very sort of base way, tied together, you know, TNR and no kill, while completely deceptive and pretty insidious, in a way, we're almost asking for it, because there's complexities to both topics that sometimes we just don't address publicly because we are still trying to get the world behind the concept of, for instance, the rights of feral cats to exist. And I saw that writing and I said, you know, all he had to do was grab these, like, you know, just, I, for lack of a better, you know, phrase, just like fourth grade talking points, and tie them together in an untenable way, but in a way that was just easily digestible. And, you know, we suffer for it, you know, and it's funny because as I'm saying that, I don't want to sort of gloss over the point that he was completely irresponsible and factually just way off base. And he's like presenting himself as half, you know, diary fiction writer guy and half journalist, and it's dangerous. And you put out information that's that misleading, and like you said, you gotta, you know, take the source. And in the past, it's been like cats no, birds yes, and he's taken sort of a page out of, you know, the PETA handbook, which is just,
I was just going to ask you, what I never understand PETA's hostility toward TNR and toward no kill shelters. It just does not compute. I understand why people in general, you don't like cats. You don't like cats around your neighborhood. You love birds and you see cats as, you know, it's the perpetual Sylvester and Tweety dynamic and you're team Tweety. So for like a Jonathan Franzen, and who, to your point, he's not a journalist. He's a novelist, and novelists are storytellers. And I say this, you know, as somebody who writes narrative myself, that even when you're writing something that's true, that there's always the, you know, kind of shoehorning things into a certain bucket because that's what fits your narrive. PETA, I don't understand their hostility. I don't know if you have any more insight or explanation into why they are so resolutely anti-TNR and anti-no-kill shelters.
Well, I mean, from a purely sort of, you know, if you look at the ideology, I think PETA has always tried to apply the, you know, the ideas of animal cruelty coming against animal cruelty into a place where it just doesn't belong. And because there's no way that you can draw parallels from rodeos or circuses or the fur industry to community cats. You just can't. It's not an available avenue, but they still talk about shoehorning. Try to paint that whole movement with that brush. And it doesn't work. But that's what Franzen did, by the way, is instead of saying, I hate cats and I love birds, he was talking about, oh, the poor cats. I actually like cats and I feel terrible for them because their life on the street is short and cruel. And that is, by and large, always been PETA's stance, that to a degree, they're better off not being on this planet than to be on this planet in the position that they're in. And of course, that's a,
I mean, I think all reasonable people who love animals could agree with a general statement that an animal who is suffering may, I mean, the same could be true for a person, by the way, that somebody who's genuinely suffering could arguably be better off dead. I mean, really, could be better off being humanely euthanized, let's say,
and that's
than being forced to live a life of misery. But, you know,
that's saying that all community cats live a life of, which they do not. And, you know, in a way, the life of a feral cat is the life of every cat before they came into our homes. They succeeded over the span of hundreds of thousands of years, where 99% of the species on this planet did not succeed because they're good at it. And because they, between hunting and scavenging and sort of self-domesticating to a certain degree, they've been successful. Does that mean there's not suffering cats on this? Of course there is. And to your point, there are suffering people on the streets. Do we want to round them up and kill them all? I mean, we apply this sort of altruistic, or PETA does this.
Somebody had an idea like that. I forget his name. There was this guy back in the 30s, 40s. Anyway.
Yeah. I mean, and how did that work out? But honestly, you know, there is a like I was saying, a dangerous precedent. Hold on. Would be my assistant telling me, Jackson, what are you doing? there's a dangerous precedent to be set when it comes to the level of irresponsibility that I think Franzen, but of course PETA, that I think that they bring to the table. And I just wish they would stay out of something that they sort of, you know,
no, I see PETA working very hard to find like worst case scenarios when it comes to no-kill shelters and then present those as if that is the norm. I mean, I have read some of their literature on the fallacy of no-kill shelters and why the no-kill movement wouldn't work. And even separate and aside from the issue of community cats, they allege all sorts of neglect and abuse or you know, that no-kill shelters will have, and which some do have very selective policies. And I'm sure there are bad people in every walk of life, but they present these things as typical. And you've been in more no-kill shelters than I've been in, and I've been in a lot of no-kill shelters. And it's just,
and I think that
I don't understand the motivation. That's the thing. Like, why?
I think the thing is that to a degree, that's the thing I was talking about, these sort of low-hanging parts of our worldview that are easy pickings for Franzen and PETA and the like. And I do think that there's a level of, you know, we do have to say, look, when we were coming up, the no-kill movement was essential because we just had to draw people's attention to the fact that, you know, killing in shelters was happening at an unbelievable number. And we were calling attention to that. And so to that end, the movement achieved what it was there to do, in my point of view anyway. And, you know, we've gone from when I first started in shelters in the early 90s, we were killing, 10 to 12 million cats and dogs every year in U.S. animal shelters. And we are, by all accounts, below a million at this point. And you know, depending on who's doing the counting, pretty well below a million. And so to that end, we do have to evolve with the moment. And I think the moment and where no kill sits in the moment is not an easy one, you know, because I think by and large, shelters and the shelter culture has evolved, and we have learned and assimilated lessons from the past and innovated along the way. And I think that to then lump all of those shelters into kill is simplistic and not all that as relevant anymore. And I think that's the part of kill no kill that becomes an easy target. And I do think that conversation does need to happen. And I do believe that we're in a really tricky moment. Really tricky, really, you know, crazy moment. I mean, I can go on about this forever, but I mean, we lost precious time during the first year of the pandemic when it comes to community cats that we haven't gotten back. And, you know, we've really gotten ourselves into a moment because during the pandemic, we lost a lot of veterinarians. We lost a lot of techs along the way. Getting appointments for TNR is rough countrywide.
Getting appointments in general is, I mean, there is a veterinarian shortage. And even just as a garden variety, you know, cat guardian, I'm certainly feeling that myself.
It's rough, man. It really, and I think we all felt it. And I think, you know, we continue to. And, it's a very large problem, and those are the places that we have to, I think, just sort of pivot to. And I do wish places like PETA would evolve as well, and take that paintbrush and take it someplace else, because they're keeping it in a theoretical place, and it doesn't belong. And this idea that, I mean, it's so infuriating in ways that if you've been in the trenches working in this world to you know, house the houseless and to educate the public and to keep the killing down, and then, you know, there's a finger being pointed going, you're not doing enough, you know, you're killing. And that's just, you know, that's cruel, you know, that's cruel to an entire population of people who have dedicated their lives to the welfare of these animals. And you and I have spent tons of time in that world. And honestly, in terms of where my work is right now, the work that we're trying to do on behalf of shelter cats and homeless cats in general and community cats is it for me. And the thing that I hope to help in whatever small way, you know, bring this chapter to a close in our lifetime. But is it helpful to have a friends in peace floating around? Was his hope to open eyes and get us to say, okay, there's more avenues? No, that came from a place of fairly disguised disdain. And PETA comes from a place of, I'm sorry, just like for the amazing work that PETA has done in animal rights over the course of my lifetime, they have not done cats and dogs any favors, and I just wish they would leave it, you know, and concentrate where their strength is.
I sometimes come back to the idea that they, I think at core, don't think that any animals should be living with any humans. and that is sort of what is behind, you know, because I really do try to come up with what would be the motivation to crap all over the no-kill movement if you are committed to the idea of saving animals' lives and committed to the idea of animal welfare. And this is one idea that I have that I think it's, you know, a particular, it's almost like a religious belief, kind of, that there should not be cohabitation between humans and animals, that any cohabitation like that is oppressive or exploitative of the animal in question. And so that is why they take some of the positions that they do.
I mean, again, it's hard to get to the heart of, you know, when a personal philosophy becomes a juggernaut and you know how that is applied. I know that there's kernels of truth in everybody's take. There's kernels of truth in Franzen's piece. There's kernels of truth in Peter's approach, but they're just kernels. And what those guys are really good at is the paintbrush. And that has worked really well for raising awareness in terms of factory farming. I think they've done amazing work in our lifetime on that one.
Absolutely.
But, you know, you get down to, and this is where I think that circles back to our talk about no kill, is if our definitions around it don't change over time, then kind of sitting ducks for that paintbrush. But I think that yeah, I mean, Peter just, it beyond, you know, how someone might feel about domestic animals in general, and to that end, whatever, good luck. But how they feel about all cats who live in communities as free roaming cats are suffering. That's a topic that I think is truly important right now, and something that we need to be speaking to, because, you know, that idea leads to people taking healthy cats off the street who live there. That's their life. A feral cat lives there. And you try to take that feral cat, define them as a house cat, as a domestic cat, try to put that square cat in the round hole, bring them to the shelter, by the way, where, you know, they think they're being well-meaning, but think, well, this is a cat that deserves to be in a home, but they don't want to be there. They're not adoptable. They die in that shelter. The shelter gets the blame for it. But in reality, it's understanding these cats' place in our community. And that's where it begins and ends. And that's where I think PETA has, you know, quite honestly just failed.
You know what? What's upsetting for me, and you and I were talking a little before we started, and I was saying that my husband and I have done, you know, a lot of traveling over the past couple of years since quarantine lifted, and I actually, without Lawrence, have done some traveling too, and gone to some places. I mean, some countries where there's a lot of poverty and animals absolutely suffer for that. I spent a couple of weeks in Albania, and I was working with a friend in rescue, and we were going to trap cats to you know, spay and neuter them, trap feral cats to spay and neuter them in the hopes of, you know, creating some population control. Albania is a poor country, and they do not care very much for, there's just a lot of stray cats and dogs. And I say stray as opposed to feral, because they are stray. But what I, and, you know, the thing is, though, we did not actually have to trap any of the cats. The cats were so hungry that we opened cans. They ran up. They did not care what we did with them as long as we fed them. They were starving. And it is, you know, there are feral cats who I feed, I mean, just in my backyard, not as part of any formal program, who are very, you know, I come out with the food, they back up, you know, a good 10 feet. I put the food down, I go inside, like that's the procedure, you know, then they come up and they eat the food. There was none of this. And I don't think it's because the cats personality wise were so much more domesticated. They were genuinely suffering and starving animals. And the point that I'm making is that there really is a difference between a street cat And I also understand that is not to say that every cat you see outdoors in the United States is living their best life, because they're not living in Albania or Morocco or Egypt or some of the other places that I've been to. But I mean, you understand the point that I'm saying, that there is a distinction that I think gets lost in articles about the hard, the difficult lives that the cats are living. There are parts of the world where that is absolutely true. And some of these animals are suffering so greatly that if you cannot house and feed them, then it might actually be better to euthanize them.
That's the thing. And that's exactly what I'm saying, is that as much as somebody would, what I'm saying right now, and try to apply a paintbrush to the world of this one topic, I refuse. I'm saying that there are complexities here that we haven't really talked about in a way that we're like, there's different approaches and different ways of approaching each member of that cat community that is different from the approach to the other. And it's just as naive for me to say that every cat living on the street is where they want to be, and like you said, living their best life. That's crazy. There's millions and millions of these cats on the street, and some of them are domestic
in crisis. Are in crisis, are not living good lives, are desperately in need of help and intervention.
And I think that the people who really are out there doing the work, are doing that work in that way, where they are assessing the health of that animal, their ability to function in that environment, and making calls from that perspective and educating on that perspective. I think one of the beautiful things about social media is that, and the first org that comes to my mind is Flatbush Cats in New York, that have done a magnificent job at documenting the lives of these cats and documenting the lives of trappers and people who care about them, and taking it one by one and saying, this cat is a cat that we trap and we, you know, leave in his world, and we maintain that world. We keep going back and making sure everyone's healthy. And this cat, we get off the street, you know, because he needs to be. And I do think that we are granted, and people who love cats all the way around are granted the opportunity now to see a situation evolve that demands more of our brains and hearts than I think we're used to devoting to the topic, because, you know, traditionally we would give you these points to think about and here, donate to this cause or volunteer for this one. You gotta understand that the house cat, the feral cat, the community cat, we're living in a point where they are all evolving, where the problem is evolving as the cats are, and we got to keep our ears to the ground. And I'm proud to whatever degree be a messenger or, you know, a advocate for them, and to teach everyone who, you know, tunes in to my channel to learn about their cat. I want them to learn about all of these cats and realize that you can have a relationship with all of them in a loving way. It just looks different. It just looks different when it's the cat in your lap and the cat under your car, but they can still be loved and advocated for. We just have to, on both sides of this thing, realize that it's more complex than it might have been, to circle back to this whole thing, when you and I were coming up and trying to educate the world about the concept of not killing in shelters. It's just, we hoped for the evolution. We hoped to unstick the whole thing from the mud. And we have, and there's been tremendous successes. The next phase of things becomes just, you know, a bigger conversation. And if there's anything, I just would invite everybody on every side of this, even if someone's listening to this and has never even considered the life of a street cat, to just start watching, reading, getting into it, and figure out the best way for you as an individual to help each of these cats. But there is a way, for sure. You know, you got me going, Gwen.
You know, I've actually been waiting to discuss this topic with you for a while. And I'm going to segue into, I guess, sort of a conclusion. But I do want to ask you, if you are a person listening to this podcast and you have been inspired by you, now that I'm using the general, you know, I'm using the specific you. If a person listening to this has been inspired by you, Jackson, to do something either to improve the life of community cats or to be more active in you know, being an advocate for the no-kill movement, what should they do? Where should they go? What's a great way to get started?
Well, I mean, the I would hope that we present good information both on my YouTube channel and also my my organization, the Jackson Galaxy Project, which is a signature program of Greater Good Charities. I think that we work our butts off to stay current and to help the animals that are affected by this, help people who work within rescue and sheltering, and to introduce all of these topics to our audience who may not have considered it before. So, you know, going to JacksonGalaxyProject.org is a good place to start. Going to GreaterGoodCharities.org is always a good place to start. My dear friend Hannah Shaw has continued to do freaking amazing work when it comes to the lives of you know, the under-socialized, unsocialized kittens in the world. She's an amazing teacher. So always check out kittenlady.org. You know, her nonprofit Orphan Kitten Club is a phenomenal place. And that's, you know, I mean, Alley Cat Allies will always be a strong place to learn about the life of community cats. There are great places. Just start somewhere. And to that end, don't trust us as a single source. Do your due diligence, you know.
Fair enough.
There's, as I was saying before, I could say something today, but we evolve. And I'm learning stuff as we're putting together. We have a program called Cat Positive 360, which we're actively right now workshopping around the country to shelters. And as we workshop it, we're growing it. We're actually picking up information from the folks who work with these animals every day and adapting our techniques and how we teach. It is important to stay nimble right now, whether you're teaching it or receiving it, but we all function from the same place. And the true heart of this is our hearts. And the fact that whether you're hearing about this for the first time or you've been working in it for 30 years, you love these cats and you love all cats and you just want to be able to make a difference in their lives. And that's how you learn. Is you just commit to learning, you know?
And yeah, no, absolutely. And I will also say to that point, by the way, that there are so many different points of entry. There are so many different ways of getting involved. I mean, there's just making a donation, which I, as a former nonprofit administrator, and I'm sure you'll back me up on this, is always welcome. It's sometimes the best thing you can do is just to give $25 a month to something you really care about. But you know, there are so many. There are, you can be a hands-on volunteer, you can be a fundraiser, you can be a person who does it, provides administrative support for a cause that you believe in. There are so many different kinds of animal welfare and animal advocacy, cat welfare and cat advocacy organizations, some that are breed specific, some that are dedicated to community cats, some that are dedicated to socializing cats who can be socialized, some that are just, you know, spay and neuter and or more traditional rescue models.
Wherever it is that you feel that you can contribute, to your point, volunteer, donate, whatever your superpower is in life, you know, there is an application. I mean, if you're great with a sewing machine, we need you to make trap covers for the trap. You have a couple of extra hours a day. We would love for you to just transport cats who are trapped to clinics to get fixed so we can get them back out there or assess them from that point. Doing anything right now, whatever that anything looks like, does something. Every single thing that you do will save a life. That's the math right now, and especially post-pandemic. So I think anybody who is inspired to action, take the action, and we will gladly
put you to work,
man. And I do want to say also that I think that it's, again, that it's important that that action that you take, you got to remember that you have to remember that the world is not black and white. The world is a gray place. And I think, you know, it's very easy in communities these days, and I live in California, where it's very easy to do, where you can demonize shelters for where their numbers are at. And you just have to remember that, yeah, there's bad administration. There's systems that can be completely overhauled, and we wish they would be. And there's also a whole lot of shelters that are doing their very best, and they need more support from the cat lovers in their community, the politicians in their community, and, you know, countywide, statewide, nationally, that they're not getting. And just remember, it dig a little deeper.
And that's, and by the way, if you're a good fetch, I mean, the political side of it is also always, if what you, and I would not be speaking from personal experience or anything, but if what you bring to this world is a loud voice and a willingness to raise it, I mean, by all means, take it. I mean, all politics is local, man. Like, take it to your city council, take it to your mayor's office, take it to your Better Business Bureau.
And you know, remember this, that we are still trying to get basic rights for these cats passed on a national level. We are a country where you can still go to a vet and have your cats mutilated. You can have them declawed, and it'll just be part of a package where you can get them spayed, neutered, and declawed. And there's no recourse. There's no moment where education can take hold. It is a cruel practice, and it still gets practiced. We can still be working on issues that call for immediate action. And the anti-declawing is one of those things that in our entire careers, you and me combined and then some, we've been trying to pass through. And but we've done great. You know, places like the Paw Project have done great in getting state laws passed, but we still are a country that tacitly condones declawing. We got to put that to an end. And to that end, fetch, be loud.
be a squeaky wheel that gets the grease.
Yes, go ahead and squeak, man. Just, you know, just take these topics that we're still trying to get across, and let's get those across the finish line as well.
Jackson, I always feel such an invigorated sense of recommitment to my purpose when it comes to animal rescue after speaking with you. Thank you so much for coming onto the podcast today.
And thank you for giving me the opportunity to fetch.
Well, you know, it's arguably what our people do best.
That's true.
All right. Thanks so much for coming on the podcast today, Jackson.
Of course.
And thanks so much to all of you for listening. Don't forget to join me next week for another all-new episode.
And that concludes this episode of Curl Up with a Cattail with Gwen Cooper. Don't forget to invite your feline-loving friends to listen to new episodes along with you. If you'd like to subscribe to this podcast, find out how to get your name and your cat's name included in my next book, or leave comments or questions for me to answer in future podcasts, head on over to gwencooper.com now. Thanks so much for joining me, and don't forget to hug your cat today.